From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. Political predictions usually aren't worth the paper they're written on or the air they're breathed into, but as we head into 2019, you can say this. It will be a major year because of the forces already in motion, both in the U.S. and globally. Washington is shut down, the House is changing hands, Wall Street is wobbly, trade tensions ratchet up. We may be in a lull before the storm of Mueller and congressional investigations, and climate change and technology continue to transform the way we live. So this hour on Point, the forces that will shape 2019. And you can join us. How are you feeling about this new year? Do you think all the things we just listed will sort themselves out? Or are you a little freaked out by it? What is your top concern? Or perhaps, to be more positive, your biggest cause for hope as we kick off 2019. Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Well, this hour we have a great panel of some big thinkers to help us look ahead to 2019. And joining us from New Haven, Connecticut is historian Beverly Gage. She's director of the program in grand strategy at Yale University and also author of the forthcoming G-Man, J. Edgar Hoover and the American Century. Beverly Gage, welcome to On Point.
Thanks, Meghna. It's great to be here.
It's great to have you. With us from Chicago is economist Diane Swank. She's chief economist and managing director with the consulting firm Grant Thornton. Diane Swank, it's great to have you on Point.
Good to be here.
And also with us is Ian Lustig. He's with us today from Philadelphia. He's a political scientist at the University of Pennsylvania, specializing in comparative politics, international relations, and Middle East politics. He's also author of the forthcoming Paradigm Lost in the Promised Land. Ian Lustig, welcome to you.
Hello, Meghna. Good to be here.
And by the way, Happy New Year to all three of you. You know, as I look across sort of the year that we just came through and the one we're heading into now, it seems to me that the one unifying theme I can pull out of all of this, and I just want to get quickly your take from the three of you, is uncertainty, right? Political uncertainty, economic uncertainty, technological changes, the uncertainty that climate change is bringing, and then sort of undergirding all of that is the uncertainty perhaps we as individuals feel about global leadership's capacity to handle all that's unknown. I mean, Diane, let me just start with you. Is that a fair analysis of what we're looking forward to in the year ahead?
Yeah, actually, excuse me, one of the hardest things to measure, but we do actually measure it as economists, is what is policy uncertainty? What is overall people's feeling about certainty in the economy? And usually when you have economic aggregates that look as good as they do, 3.7% unemployment rate, close to 3% growth, you would see, and wages finally accelerating, you'd see a sense of complacency and maybe caution about the year ahead, but not this uncertainty that we've got unprecedented level of uncertainty on the policy front. And what it means is that it's leaving businesses and consumers a little hesitant as we walk into 2019 and approach the year to move forward. There's a veil of uncertainty that needs to be lifted so that we know we can see the road ahead. And right now, it's a little hazy.
Right. So, Beverly, let me lean on your expertise as a historian then here. I mean, what are the analogous eras in U.S. history that contain the same sort of kinds of uncertainty people are feeling now?
Well, I think Donald Trump has introduced a new level of sort of predictable unpredictability in which we all have learned that the attempts at prognostication are often wrong. And the 2016 election, I think, for many experts as well as many political watchers, was a grand lesson in that. All of that said, I think there have been lots of moments in American history where there was a sense of division and a sense that you weren't sure exactly what was ahead, and except to know that it was going to be driven by some pretty dramatic events. So if you look at the 1930s and the uncertainty surrounding the fate of the Great Depression and the war that was sweeping over Europe, right, that was a moment when people found it very difficult to predict from year to year what might happen. The late 1960s, early 1970s, that's another moment when people were really worried that actually society itself was going to be in some sort of state of collapse. So while I think there are particular things that are new about this unpredictability, it's certainly not something altogether new.
So Ian, let's pick up on what Beverly just said, though, because I think the defining new thing, as she's saying, is that so much of the unpredictability is coming from the president of the United States here.
Well, let's talk about how the uncertainty, which we always have, the world is much more complex at the level that we're talking about than anyone can understand or predict. How is it distributed? When uncertainty gets really dangerous, when it's concentrated into events that could explode and transform the kinds of values that we see as at stake. So when I look around the world now and try to see how it's distributed, that's what's scary because of the possibility that we're on the cusp of certain big changes. One of them, I think, could be in Afghanistan, where it's not at all impossible. In fact, it's much more plausible than many other scenarios that there'll be a cascading failure there and we'll end up with a kind of Saigon evacuation in Kabul. I think that's something which is not on the radar screen of most Americans, but which is definitely a problem. And there's all kinds of possibilities with China. It's a historic, epic story of a new power rising and declaring what the United States did when it was a new power rising almost 200 years ago, declaring a Monroe Doctrine for the entire Asian area, East and Southeast Asia. How might that produce clashes with an American power that's in retreat? But it's also important to think of what kind of uncertainty is reduced. One of the things that gave us the Iraq War was that the American power, unchecked in the world as it was at that time, could unleash itself as a result of very trivial and whimsical developments within the American polity. And we get an utter disaster as a result, something that was not predictable a year and a half before. And we see in the movie Vice just how small, you know, one man wants to impress his wife and we end up with a couple million dead in the Middle East. There are some ways in which the world moving toward a more balanced, multipolar arrangement it reduces some of the uncertainty, but it increases it in other ways.
Yeah. And by the way, before we move on, Ian, I apologize for mispronouncing your name a minute ago. I will not get it wrong. Again, names are important.
I congratulate you on getting it right the first time.
Okay. Well, you know, I want to keep building on this question of sort of the uncertainty and the unpredictability of so many forces at play right now and how that might help shape 2019. And in order to do so, let me just quickly go to a recent interview that retired General Stanley McChrystal, who's the former command of the Joint Special Forces operations, and he did that in the 2000s. In the 2000s, I should say. He spoke with Martha Raddatz on ABC this weekend, and she, you know, asked him rather bluntly whether or not he believes the president of the United States is a liar, whether he believes the president is immoral, and McChrystal answered in the affirmative to both. And then Raddatz went on and asked him this.
What would you say to those Americans then, and there are a lot of them, who support Donald Trump, who say, I like what he's doing, he's shaking things up, I don't care about this other stuff?
Yeah, I would say everyone has to make their own judgment. I can't tell any supporter of one politician or another that they are wrong. But what I would ask every American to do is, again, stand in front of that mirror and say, what are we about? Am I really willing to ignore some of the things that people do that are pretty unacceptable normally just because they accomplish certain other things that we might like? If we want to be governed by someone we wouldn't do a business deal with because their background is so shady, if we're willing to do that, then that's in conflict with who I think we are.
That's retired General Stanley McChrystal on ABC this weekend. Beverly Gage, what do you hear in McChrystal speaking out like that?
Well, in part, I hear someone who is seeing, for better or worse, much of his life's work being dismantled. And I think this is the case for a lot of people who have worked in kind of non-electoral government over the last couple of decades. One of the big features of Donald Trump has been, certainly within Washington, to go to war against the administrative state, to go to war against experts, to go to war against people who have made their careers within a certain system that he now has set out both to ignore and then to some degree to dismantle. I actually think that that struggle between people who have been in government service for many years, take it seriously, have a variety of political opinions, but really believe in the project of governance, what their relationship is going to be to Donald Trump moving forward, who is someone who has very little respect for all of that, and who's really going to be the decision maker in the end, and how that war is going to play out, I think is going to be of one of the most consequential long-term features of the Trump presidency, but also is really going to shape what happens in 2019, both in terms of foreign affairs, but also, you know, in terms of what's happening with Mueller, in terms of Trump's relationship with the intelligence agencies, in terms of whether he's even going to fill positions within many of the, the agencies that are really languishing or understaffed and at the moment shut down many of them.
Right. Well, so Diane Swonk, we've got about 45 seconds before we have to take a quick break here, but how do you see that particular long-term uncertainty that Beverly's talking about playing out in, you know, the what feels like all of a sudden, I don't want to say shaky economy, but uncertainty throughout, you know, certain sectors of the economy?
Well, I think what we're seeing is a gap between perception and reality, and that's been that wedge has started before this election, but was certainly made much larger by this particular president. And what we've seen in Washington on a policy basis is ideology sort of override the evidence-based work that a lot of economists have done, a lot of policymakers have done, a lot of historians have done, a lot of political scientists have done. And in that, we're getting bad policies because of perception. And I think that's something that I worry about most in 2019.
Well, we are taking a look at the year to come, 2019, and the forces that are already at play that will shape the coming year. Joining me this hour is Diane Swonk, Beverly Gage, and Ian Lustig. And we want to hear from you. What are your hopes, your concerns for 2019? What do you think will shape the year to come? We've obviously got technology, the Mueller investigation, trade around the world. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about the forces that may shape the year to come, that may shape 2019. And I'm joined today by Ian Lustig. He's professor of political science at the University of Pennsylvania. Beverly Gage is also with us. She's a historian and professor of history and director of the program in grand strategy at Yale University. And Diane Swonk is with us. She's chief economist and managing director with the consulting firm Grant Thornton. And let's actually go straight to the phones here. Let's go to John, who's calling from Bangor, Maine. You're on the air, John.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. This is a good conversation, and I'll just kind of give you a brief as quickly as possible. I'm a business owner here in the Bangor, Maine area. The way things have been going for me personally, I'm a Republican. I am very disappointed with the state of the United States at the moment. To kind of touch base with the general set, I'd rather go down the road with someone who has pride and honesty than to go down the road of someone who's a liar and a deceiver. So in a nutshell, I was raised in the type of sense where you go down working hard for someone who's honest and works hard and tells the truth, and someone who's a liar, even if you seem like you're making money and the economy's going good and everything is great, you just don't follow that just because you're doing appear to be doing good on paper.
Okay, John, I'm going to just jump in here. Don't hang up. Okay, hang on here for just a second, because I hear you saying that you have concerns. I think what you're saying is with the behavior of the president of the United States here, and you have those concerns as a Republican. So don't hang up, John, because I want to go to Dwayne, who's calling from Plant City, Florida. Dwayne, you're on the air, and what do you think about what you just heard John from Maine saying?
Well, I think he's wrong about that, Donald Trump. I think that the Congress and the Senate and all the politicians are liars, and they'll tell you one thing and do another. Chuck Schumer, Nancy Pelosi, Dianne Feinstein, Maxine Waters, Dick Durbin, every one of them needs to go. They are the problem. They've been the problem all along. They don't want a border wall, but yet they live behind a gated community. They don't want firearms for legal people, but yet they have armed bodyguards. I tell you what we need to do. Let's get rid of them or cut their pay.
Okay, Dwayne, hang on here. Okay, because I want to see what John in Maine has to say about that. Because John, it sounds like, well, Dwayne is basically saying he sees the entire Democratic Party as the problem. But how do you respond to that?
Well, the way I respond to that is that I've been a Republican for over 50 years. And the first thing, the problem with what he's saying is, it's not true. He is right. There's a lot of corruption in the world, period. But when you've got people that do fact checks who can determine if a person says that building, for example, Home Depot building logo color is orange,
mm-hmm.
and then another fellow comes by and says, no, that's purple. It's just the facts. It's just the way it is. I'm sorry this gentleman feels the way he feels, but he has to have concrete information to prove it. He has to prove what he's saying. I can prove what I'm saying. Donald Trump is a liar. He should not be a part of our a party at all.
Yeah.
I miss Bush. You may not like Bush, but you know what? At the end of the day, you knew you had someone that was going to say, you know, you may not like me, but this mm-hmm. is the way it is, and it's the truth.
Well, let me
I'm sorry,
John, didn't mean to interrupt there, but let me just give Dwayne one more chance here. Dwayne, John is saying that basically you do not have the facts on your side, and that's a problem. What do you think?
Well, it's just like this. You look at Bill Clinton's term, the Republicans, the Contract for America. The Republicans worked with Bill Clinton. Bill Clinton got a lot of stuff done because the Republicans didn't pull the other way. They went with him on some stuff. And some of it wasn't that great, but they still went with him.
Well, then they impeached him.
Pelosi and every one of those guys in the Democratic Party are spiteful, vindictive people. They don't want to get nothing done. Look at California. California is in debt more than most countries are.
Yeah. Well, you know what, Dwayne, I'm going to take it back from you there. Dwayne from Plant City, Florida, and John from Bangor, Maine, thank you both so much for calling and for engaging with me on this. Ian Lustig, let me turn back to you. The reason why I wanted to let Dwayne and John sort of talk it out there a little bit is because I think perhaps you can say that people who call into to radio talk shows may present, how representative they are about how the country as a whole feels, but I do feel a certain energy there in both Dwayne and John that links to why people perhaps aren't as positive about what might be coming in 2019 as they should be. I mean, what did you hear in their two takes?
Well, I want to also say that this is a good moment, and that was a great conversation to have, but we have to put the media into the equation as well.
Yeah.
Because what these folks are responding to is a transformation of the way news in America is presented, from something that focuses on policy, as was discussed before, to a sporting event. News has become a sporting event, which means that all attention is on the skills or the thoughts of the players. Who will win and who will lose this game? What is the next play going to be? What are they saying in the huddle? And aside from that, it's only one sport, and that sport's name is Trump. So the entire focus of the country is on essentially meaningless trivialities when you look at where the country, as big as we are and where our problems are headed. We need to step back and look at the political consequences, the long term, which I mean 3 to 5 years. So, for example, the conversation they were having is fundamentally about impeachment. Now, let's ask ourselves about impeachment. Impeachment is a political decision. That is it to say, what is a high crime and misdemeanor is defined only by what a majority in the House of Representatives say it is. And that's a political decision as to whether it's worthy to impeach a president. Of course, that doesn't mean conviction. The larger political question is whether it's a good thing for the country that a president, under the current kinds of conditions, would be impeached or even convicted. And that is a political decision, too. It has to do with calculating over the next 3 to 5 years what the consequences of such an action would be compared to what would develop if a Trump presidency continues for 2 years in terms of the development of the Republican and Democratic parties, the kinds of issues that will present themselves and defined as presenting themselves in the 2020 elections. And from my point of view, it may not be true for others, it depends what your interests are, that it is important not to go down the road of thinking that the solution to America's problems with the Trump administration is a legal solution through Mueller, enough crimes or enough errors produced by Mueller that could justify an impeachment. This is a political decision, and the political process is working. We saw that in the last election, and Trump is feeling it every day as the rubber bands of American institutions and world power snap back at him every time he uses his gut to lurch in one direction or another.
Well, Beverly, is that you who wants to jump in there? Because I was going to ask you about the strength of those very institutions that Diane is talking about.
Right. Well, I think one of the pieces that was very interesting about the conversation that you were hearing between the two listeners is that for both parties, but maybe especially for the Republicans, we really are at a moment of internal struggle. And I think one of the most important things that's going to happen over the next couple of years is to see what kinds of decisions these parties ultimately make as institutions. For the Republicans, the big question, and it's going to be about impeachment, but it's going to be about lots of other things too, is whether they are going to become the party of Trump in some definitive way, at which point people who don't like Trump, who consider themselves Republicans, are going to have to find a new home, a different way of doing politics, or whether you're going to take a different turn there. And the Democrats are having their own set of internal conflicts that I think are going to be pretty fierce and pretty interesting over the next couple of years. Mm. One of those is a battle between, I would say, the people who have really been in charge of the party over the last 20 years, sort of moderate liberals, and a new kind of insurgent left that's coming up within the party. And then there are also these tactical questions that I think are going to be extremely divisive within the Democratic Party as well as within the Republican Party.
Well, Diane Swank, go ahead.
Sorry, I wanted to jump in because this is a critical issue, is that the gap between perception and reality, that's already been discussed, but that wedge has wedged itself into politics as well. The left wing of the Democratic Party, the right wing or the Trump wing of the, I'm not sure which what the wing is anymore of the Republican Party. But I think that's really important because it's having an impact on policy today, which will affect us now and will affect us in the next couple of years. As you mentioned, Ian, it's actually just 2 to 3 years down the road. We're not talking about 20 years down the road anymore. Immigration, how are we going to solve this issue? Our listener in Maine, they are so strapped for workers. They have hardly any young people in the state of Maine, and they need immigrants, and they couldn't use immigrants, and they lost business due to immigrants over the summer. This is the case across much of the country in different forms. How do we deal with immigration? If we do not deal with immigration, we're already cutting and curbing legal and illegal immigration is way down, way, way down. As a result, we could have a contraction in our labor force with the aging demographics of the baby boom as soon as 2020. That is not anywhere way down the road. That is something that the employers I'm talking to today are concerned about. They're worried about the skills that that we've left our workers without, the inability we've had to invest in human capital. We are not addressing our debt problems, our fiscal sustainability, the next recession, what will be our tools. And in those institutions, they're not all snapping back. I have great faith in the Federal Reserve, but going after the chairman of the Federal Reserve, which really many people naively think is lumped in with the rest of Washington, they are not. The politics of the Federal Reserve are not Democrat, Republican politics, or anything else related to Washington. They're about debating what's best for the economy. They have a mandate. And, you know, this sort of demonizing of the Federal Reserve as well. All of these things have consequences that I worry about in terms of the economy going forward. Not only in 2019, I think we could actually hit a recession in 2020. And I don't want to get there. But we're at the point where these straws are building on the top of the camel's back. You never know which one will break the camel's back. But it's time to start unloading the burden on the camel.
You know, so Ian, let me turn back to you here for a second, because I think I take the point that all three of you are making, that a lot, very enormous changes are not, you know, far off on the horizon, on the distant horizon, but just around the corner, perhaps. But I want to loop back to one thing that you said, Ian, about the role the media has to play in all of this, in sort of reducing American political complexities or even global complexities down to a sport. I mean, I stand here as a member of the media, and we are here all here on a radio program as well. So, I just wanted to ask you, though, isn't this problem perhaps going to even get worse now that we're at 2019, which is on the edge of 2020 and another campaign season?
Yes. I'm sure most of America fears the election coverage that's going to start in about a month.
Or now.
I think it already started.
I want to point out that here I am in Philadelphia, and I'm a Philadelphia Eagles fan, and the facts of the matter don't count. It's almost all emotion. Sports mobilizes support for a team on the basis of emotion. And that's what our elections and that's what politics have become. And you could hear it between the two callers. Facts aside, there's an emotional aspect where your feeling about your self-worth is at stake now in politics. Trump is exploiting that to the hilt. And that focuses on immediate sports time. What we have to think about are the two other kinds of time, which I think the other speakers here have been referring to, and that strategic time, the things that you can imagine policies doing in two or three to five years. But those policies are important because they operate in evolutionary time, in decades.
Yes.
The climate change, migration across the world, the stability of a new world order that doesn't have that's based on a tripartite great power arrangement that's more similar to the 1920s or the 19th century than it has been for the last 40 years. Those are things which the policies we are adopting or not adopting now will shape the opportunities and dangers we face in that time span. And it's the job of the media to resist reporting sports time. Resist having every single program, every single day be about the tactics of the Trumpies versus the anti-Trumpies, and focus on the kinds of problems and policy issues that we've been speaking about in this program.
Right. Well, you know what? I've just I don't want to say in defense because I don't feel defensive right now, but in praise of the program that I work on and the people who work here, that is exactly what we try to do, to bring some context to what feels like highly emotional moments right now. So let's go to one more caller here before we have to take a quick break. Let's go to David, who's calling from Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. David, you're on the air.
Hi, Magna. I'm very optimistic with the House having flipped to the Democrats, and not as it pertains to impeaching Trump. I want to see him voted out legitimately. But I think that they're going to bring to surface the cowardice of the GOP in failing to honor their oath to the American people out of fear of a minority base. It makes absolutely no sense. And I personally believe that the GOP is going to carry the stain and stench of that cowardice for generations.
Well, David, thank you for your call. Beverly Gage, you hear an optimist there, basically saying that he believes the system will work.
Yeah, well, that's good to hear. I think that's an unusual voice to hear in certain ways, although I do also think that there are places to watch for optimism. One cautionary note, which is that when Nixon left office in 1974, of course, people said, ah, the Republicans, they're done for a generation. That's it. And of course, 6 years later, we had Ronald Reagan. That didn't actually turn out to be the case. But one place that we haven't talked about as much that I think is really interesting and in many ways optimistic is what's going on with social movements, with citizen activism in this country, right? It's not just the politics of Washington that are going to shape what happens going forward, but we have seen over the last several years a whole flowering of new movements from Me Too to Parkland. And the question is whether they're going to sustain, whether they're going to have a big impact going forward.
Mm. Well, we are talking about the forces that can and will shape 2019 politically, economically, socially, as you just heard. I'm speaking this hour with Beverly Gage, Ian Lustick, and Diane Swonk, and we want to hear from you. What are your concerns, your hopes for 2019? I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about the forces that can and will shape 2019. And I'm joined today by a great panel. Ian Lustick is with us. He's professor of political science at the University of Pennsylvania. Beverly Gage also joins us. She's a professor of history and director of the program in grand strategy at Yale University. And Diane Swonk is with us. She's chief economist and managing director with the consulting firm Grant Thornton. And Diane, I wanted to sort of draw our lens out a little more broadly and look globally, because all of you have mentioned, we were talking about uncertainty and the big questions that are looming in 2019. And Ian had been talking a little bit earlier about, China and its positioning on the world stage. It's sort of a Chinese manifest destiny, perhaps, we're seeing playing out from Beijing. I mean, next week, in the coming days, we are going to have the next round of trade talks between the U.S. and China. I mean, you were just before the break, you were talking about how so many major issues aren't 5 or 10 years out, but, a year or two or now even days.
Well, in fact, today the market opened down because China showed more weakness than many expected. And that's already the residual effects, not only of the trade war and trade skirmishes, which many people are at the front lines of out in the Midwest and in the manufacturing sector and in the farm sector, but there's something more larger than just that. China is the second largest economy in the world now, and it's got the largest debt run-up we've ever seen in a 15-year period of time ever that we've ever recorded, with no cycle to it. We don't know how they'll handle it. We don't know what will happen. There's many speculating that China will enter a period much like Japan of a slow couple of decades as a result of this debt bubble bursting at some point in time. That said, unlike Japan in the 1980s and 1990s, when the bubble burst at the latter part of the 1980s, we saw Japan isolated. Uh-huh. China has tentacles in every economy in the world and has spillover effects around the world. It's a huge market for Europe and for Japan. It is the collateral damage and the contagion effects are quite high. And that damage has already been done, and they can paper over it with more debt for a period of time. But at some point in time, that ends. And what we don't know is what that'll look like. At the same time that Ian pointed out, you know, they're building up themselves militarily. They're trying to get a new dominance in the world. And as their own economy implodes a bit, how will they handle themselves militaristically? How will they challenge the U.S.? And I think these are major things that are going to be seen in the next couple of years and maybe even sooner. We're already seeing the volatility of China's performance on what it means for our own stock market. And getting a trade deal or not, there will be something superficial done. But the gap between, you know, what China wants to be and what the U.S. wants China to be are quite large. And there won't be bridging that gap. There will be just some very small ways that we paper over what is still a very big fission between us.
Well, so, Ian, is that, I mean, gaps are another recurring theme in this hour. Is that are the consequences of that gap that Diane was talking about exacerbated by, you know, the newly fragile relationship that the U.S. has with its allies?
The United States is retrenching from the world. And that's not an entirely bad thing, but the way it's being done this president is destroying the soft power that we've built up by being the leader of the free world, by being the leader of a Western alliance which had ambitions and to a certain extent was succeeding in promoting an international liberal world order. That is not crystallizing anymore. That is not in place. The question is when we do reemerge, we're going to have to reengage as Russia and China become much more assertive and establish spheres of influence where we will not be able to operate easily at all. When that happens, we will reengage, but we will reengage with, as possible, without the credit, the soft power, the system of alliances, mainly our European allies, who will come and are coming to distrust us and have no idea really how to depend on us, whether they can depend on us. So that's the sense in which the decisions being made now and in the next couple of years will shape what happens in the next 10 to 15 years when we will have to reengage in a world of powers that are equal to us in many respects. And with respect to the economic challenge that China faces and therefore the economic challenge that the whole world faces, let's just note how the United States actually dragged itself out of the Great Depression. We did it through World War II.
Mm-hmm.
We never really recovered until we were involved in World War II that created the demand and the mass mobilization. And that is a scary thought when you think of how China would be in a position to face its economic depression. Now, I'm not saying that's what's going to happen. The world is different now. But that's the scale of the problem that, from a grand strategic point of view, you should be thinking about in Washington. People should be thinking about it, and their thoughts should matter to decision makers. And, of course, the decision makers in the White House now, those are the kind of thoughts that just do not matter.
Well, Beverly, I'm going to turn to you in a second here, but let's go to another caller on this point. Mike is calling from Berea, Kentucky. Mike, you're on the air.
Hello, everyone.
Hi, Mike. Go ahead.
Hello.
All right, so I just want to kind of raise the stakes of this conversation just a bit in the fact that I feel like this is a very dangerous case of nuclear weapons combined with the emperor's not wearing any clothes, and that while I appreciate the conversation that you're having, you know, if this gentleman is being rebuffed by generals and admirals, and his Secretary of Defense, a man that I truly believe to be an honorable man, is resigning in protest. You know, we have a bigger issue on our hands than maybe what when we get down in the mire of it and we're discussing what's going on. You know, this man is perhaps very dangerous, and I think with the military individuals resigning at the levels that they are and the words that are being spoken by them, like, we need to talk not necessarily about impeachment or about conviction or but what we're going to do as a republic to survive this.
Mike, can I just jump in here for a second? Do you have experience or are you a member of the military yourself?
I'm a former Marine.
Okay. So because I hear what you were saying when you were talking about about former Secretary Mattis there here. So, but to talk to me a little bit more, explain to me, I mean, how concerned are you? Specifically, what are you saying?
You all talked earlier about, you know, there is corruption everywhere. One of your callers said there is corruption everywhere. The two gentlemen that had the conversation. Mm-hmm. And while that is true, our system is designed to have a series of checks and balances, and it's kind of a knife fight in a phone booth. But the people that wrote the documents that we live by didn't necessarily see Donald Trump coming or a man like Trump. And with the power of social media and the power of stardom and the way that we watch reality television, you know, we created this. You know, we built the possibility of this. And there was the gentleman who was the media manager for Donald Trump prior, or maybe even transitioned into the campaign, somewhere around there. And his quote was, realizing that Donald Trump could tweet himself was like realizing that in Jurassic Park, the velociraptor could open the doors.
Mike, thank you for your call. Ian, go ahead.
Yes, I think what Mike is pointing to is something that many Americans feel and are terrified by, and that is the idea that the president that is not fact-based could start a nuclear war. We all have the image of a button which the president can push, and that's a terrifying thing unless you feel that the president is a reasonable person. I think that one of the things that is not well understood is that there are actually many checks and balances within the specific apparatus to control nuclear weapons, that the standard operating procedures that govern the use of nuclear weapons are contained in books that are about a foot thick and that have every possible contingency and that the president has a whole series of consultations that have to occur under almost any circumstance in which nuclear weapons could come into play. So that combined with what I believe is happening in the military, which is a revulsion and against this president because of the kinds of decisions that he is making that end up putting American warriors in a position where they are betraying the people that they've been working with for years, are creating more barriers to Trump's ability to do what he might do on impulse. So I think there's room, though we don't have the opportunity to go into details, to reassure many Americans that particular kind of catastrophe is maybe less likely than they might imagine.
Okay. Well, Beverly Gage, let me turn to you. You are the director of the program in grand strategy at Yale here. I have to say I am not as well read as I should be into the protocols around launching a nuclear strike here, because I remember just a couple of days ago, the Washington Post reported that with or without Mattis, the president has unchecked and complete authority to launch nuclear weapons based on his discretion.
Right. Well, I'm not an expert in nuclear protocol either, so we might want to leave the details of that to someone who is. But I do think two things to say. One is that one of the things that we're seeing play out with Trump is that over the past century, but even in much more recent years, we've seen enormous concentration in the power of the presidency. And some of that Donald Trump has, in fact, been able to exercise, and some of it he hasn't. And so I do think, for better or worse, we're seeing a real experiment in what the actual institutional limits are on the power of the presidency and what it is, in fact, that we have unleashed by concentrating so much power in the executive. The other thing that I would just say from a historical perspective, and this goes back to a little bit of what Ian was saying, but also to what the caller was bringing up, is that though the United States has been at war in some sense for a very sustained period of time, it's been a very limited experience. We have an all-volunteer military at this point.
Right.
And one of the things that people often say about why it is we're seeing, certainly among the American public, maybe a lessened commitment to this vision that came out of 1945 of what's often called the liberal international order or institutions like NATO, is that Americans have in fact forgotten the experience of what it was like when a real global crisis came that resulted in a massive global war that killed 60 million people. Now, maybe we're at a moment in history where those kinds of things aren't going to happen on the scale that they did two generations ago at this point. But I think we can't be sure of that. And it is actually worth keeping in mind the fragility of our institutions and the fragility of these kinds of relationships going forward that I think we've taken for granted.
Well, that is certainly a sobering thought, because I don't think anyone listening would want to even dare – would hope that anything, a catastrophe of that magnitude, would befall us now. But, you know, we've got just about 3 minutes left here in this conversation, and I wanted to end by asking all of you, and Diana, I'll start with you, about, you know, if there's one thing that you wish would happen or will happen in 2019, what would it be?
Really want clarity instead of chaos. We cannot have policy delivered by tweet. We need to have some rules of the road to lift that veil of uncertainty, to know what the speed limits are, what the guardrails are, so we can move forward. And to the extent that Congress can move forward and define that, that would be something I'd welcome with open arms. Even if it didn't have all the perfect policies that I wanted, at least if there was purpose to the policies, I think that would be helpful.
With a divided Congress, though, I mean, do you think that that's possible?
You know, there are overlaps, and it's really interesting is where we could see some compromise, although, no, I'm not optimistic. You asked me what I want.
This is
a wish list.
Okay. Well,
I think I was just hacked by the Chinese when I talked about China to get taken out of the program.
Okay, well you have been returned to us, thank goodness. Ian Lustig, let me turn to you. The one thing that you wish would or will happen in 2019?
I'd like to see 13 Republican senators suck it up and say what they actually think about policy questions that come before them. I think that would be enough. I'm not interested so much, as I said before, in impeachment, but enough to put the country back in a direction where the country starts to see Washington as capable of identifying and addressing problems, and in which, if those problems aren't addressed, the blame is clearly put where it belongs, which is on the current president. That kind of a small change would have an enormous effect on the way the country responds across the board.
Yeah.
And so I'm wishing for as small a change as possible that would have as many big payoffs.
But Ian, just briefly, if I may ask you, I mean, you talked about Republican
that
senators
will,
regarding
right,
regarding policy. Haven't they already been doing that? And in fact, maybe a lot of them do agree with the policies the president is issuing.
I don't think that that's true. I think, of course, some senators that's true, but many it's not. And you can tell from those who are resigning and retiring and speaking their mind. I, by the way, don't think this will happen unless the president's polling numbers go below 30.
Mm-hmm. Well, Beverly Gage, last thought goes to you. Your hope for 2019.
Okay. Well, I'll offer two. They're both smallish, but I think with big impact potentially. One, I would like to see a generational shift in leadership of the Democratic Party. And the other is I would like to see more teachers' strikes, because that has been something pretty remarkable to watch. It's brought new and different kinds of people into politics. I think it's had a dramatic impact, and it has the potential to do something that is both small and, over the long term, possibly transformative.
Well, I want to thank all three of you for joining us this hour and for helping us begin to think through what 2019 might have in store for us. Beverly Gage, historian and professor and director of the program in Grand Strategy at Yale University. Beverly, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And Ian Lustig, professor of political science at the University of Pennsylvania. Ian, it was a pleasure to have you. Thank you.
Thank you, Megan.
And Diane Swonk, chief economist and managing director of the consulting firm Grant Thornton. Always a pleasure to speak with you, Diane. Thank you so very much.
Thank you.
And by the way, folks, you can subscribe to the On Point newsletter. You go to our homepage. That's at onpointradio.org. And there you'll get weekly. Well, go to our homepage to find how to subscribe, I should say. And in the newsletter, you'll get weekly messages from my colleague David Folkenflik and me and some highlights from the show of the week. So definitely do that. Onpointradio.org is where to go. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.